God burdens me. You may not believe it, Lord, but I constantly pray Christ's prayer from Gethsemane, to let the cup pass from me. But Christ has not seen fit to spare me, so I must drain the cup, however bitter.
When your grandfather was dying, I said, he told me the crown of Wessex was a crown of thorns.
If it's worth anything, Ethelston had said forcibly, it must be a crown of thorns.
You'd be a good king, I said grudgingly.
And I will be a king who will not fight against you.
I might not trust Edward, but I trusted Ethelston. He was like his grandfather, King Alfred, a man of his word. If he said he would not fight against me, he would not. Do we tell anyone of this pact? I had asked.
I think it best if we keep it between ourselves, Lord,
he had said,
and perhaps our closest advisers.
He had hesitated.
Can I ask what Edgifu wanted of you?
My support. He had shuddered.
She's ambitious.
He made it sound unpleasant,
and of course she has the king's ear.
More than his ear.
And you told her what, Lord?
I told her nothing. I just looked at her tits and listened to her. He had grimaced at that.
Nothing.
She was too clever to ask me for anything because she knew what I'd say. That whole conversation was merely a show to convince Athelhelm that I was her ally.
She's a clever woman, he said quietly.
But her eldest son is too young to become king, I said.
But half the West Saxons claim I'm a bastard, he said. And the other half knows that Elfweird is unfit to be a ruler, so perhaps her infant son would be a safer choice.
He glanced at the wooden cross.
Maybe he's the right choice.
He's too young. Besides, you're the eldest son. The throne should be yours. He nodded.
I feel unworthy, he said softly. But my prayers have convinced me that I would be a better king than Elfweird.
He made the sign of the cross.
May God forgive my pride in saying that.
There's nothing to forgive, I said harshly.
Elfweird must not inherit the throne, he said, still speaking softly. He is rotten with corruption.
Men say that of me too, Lord Prince, I said. They call me priest-killer, pagan, and worse, but you still want my oath. He had been silent for a moment, with his eyes lowered and his hands clasped almost as if in prayer. Then he had looked at me.
I trust you, Lord. The lady Ethelfled, before she died, told me to trust you, to put my faith in you as she had done. So, yes, Lord, if I am to fulfill my God's commands, then I want your oath. And you may swear it on any god you please.
So I gave it to him. I knelt, took the oath, and he knelt and gave me his oath. And I thought that by giving him a promise and in turn receiving his promise, that we had shaped the future together. And though it is true that we have both kept the promises we made that night, the future still made itself. Wyrd byth full arad.
What I don't understand, Seatrigger asked as we rode home, is why they went to all that trouble. Why not simply invade now?
Because they're squabbling like stoats in a sack, I said. Edward wants to invade, but he needs the support of Athelhelm. If he doesn't have Athelhelm's troops, then his army is cut in half.
Why doesn't Athelhelm support him?
Because Athelhelm wants to lead the invasion himself, I guessed, and end up owning most of Northumbria. Edward doesn't want that. He wants Northumbria for himself.
Why doesn't he just kill the bastard?
Because Athelhelm is powerful. Attacking Athelhelm means civil war. And Athelhelm won't support Edward till Edward declares Elfweird as the next king. Seatrigger snorted.
Easy, then. Just make the declaration.
But anyone of sense in Wessex and Mercia knows that Elfweird is a piece of shit. If Edward names Elfweird as his heir, then he could provoke another rebellion. The Mercians want Æthelstan, probably. The sensible West Saxons want anyone except Elfweird, but not Æthelstan. They might side with Aegifu, I don't know.
Why not just support Æthelstan? He's the eldest son.
Because their goddamn priests preach that Æthelstan is a bastard. And he's spent most of his life in Mercia, which means that most West Saxons don't know him and don't know if they'll prosper under his rule. The fervent Christians support him, of course, at least those who don't believe he's a bastard, but most of the bishops and abbots are in Æthelhelm's pay, so they want Elfweird. Aedgifu doesn't want either, because she thinks her son ought to be king, and I don't doubt she's recruiting followers by spreading her legs. It's a royal mess.
So, my queen is a bastard.
She's not, I said firmly.
But they say she is.
The church says so.
So why marry her to me?
Because they think you're stupid enough to believe that a bastard royal is a pledge of their sincerity, and because it confuses the Scots.
Them too? How?
Because making Aedgith your queen, I suggested, tells the Scots that you're allied with her father. And that might make the hairy bastards think twice before they try to take Northumbria as their own. The West Saxons don't want you to lose half of Northumbria before they take it all for themselves.
Even so, he said, Aedgith's not much of a prize, is she?
She's a good woman, I said firmly, and I like her. He laughed at that, then spurred on. I did like Aedgith. She had her twin brother's good sense and her own gentle demeanour. Her marriage had come as a complete surprise to her. She had resigned herself to a life of prayer as a virtual prisoner in a convent. Then, just 6 days before the Witan, she had been plucked from the cloister, given cast-off clothes that had belonged to Edward's previous wife, and brought north to Tamworthin. The speed with which Edward had made that decision was impressive, and I wondered why, then decided that the marriage was not really intended as a gesture to Seatrigger. My daughter's death had offered Edward, or more probably his closest advisers, an unexpected opportunity to give Æthelhelm a subtle warning. Edward, by acknowledging Aedgith as his child, and by making her a queen, was suggesting he might make her twin brother into a king, and that threatened the future of Elfweird, Æthelhelm's nephew. Yet Edward had also made sure that Elfweird alone sat in a place of honour at the Witan, and so had preserved Æthelhelm's hopes. The West Saxon court, I reflected, was a wasp's nest, and I had secretly added my own sting to that royal mess. And so we rode north, going to war.
Part 3. Fortress of the Eagles. Chapter 9.
At Bebbanburg the sea kept up its ceaseless beat, and the wind brought the smell of salt with the seabirds' cries. I had been away too long. And at Bebbanburg I had to listen to the sympathy folk felt for Stiora, and the anger they harboured against her killers, and all I could do was promise revenge. Taking revenge was another matter. Skoll, I knew, was somewhere in Cumberland. That was all I knew. Whether he was on the coast or in the hills, I did not know. Brother Beedwulf, who had stayed in Jofawick with the squirrel, had told me that Skoll had captured a silver mine in the hills, but when I had pressed him for more, he confessed he knew almost nothing.
I heard men speak of him, Lord, that's all. He lived far to the north of Arnborg's Hall, I know that much.
And he has a silver mine?
I heard men say that, Lord.
I had heard rumours of a silver mine in Cumberland, but such tales were common, and the mines elusive. My father had once become excited at the report of a gold mine in the hills, and for weeks he talked of the wealth we would have and the coins he would strike, but his search parties found nothing. It was far easier to risk the dragons and the ghosts by tearing apart the burial mounds of the ancient people, though usually the graves yielded nothing but cheap pottery and dry bones. I had shared the rumour of a silver mine with Seatrigger, and knew he had men crossing the hills to search for both silver and skull. I, too, sent out warbands, usually a score of men who were told to avoid a fight with Skull's followers. "I just need to know where he lives," I insisted to them. "Discover that, and then come home." See, Trigger's first instinct, like mine, had been to assemble an army and ride westwards without delay, but sense had made us both pause. Lincoln, like Jofawick and Bebbanburg, had to be garrisoned, as did the lesser fortresses of Northumbria. Wessex might have signed a peace treaty, but if we stripped our garrisons of our best troops, then the temptation might have been too great, and I did not trust Edward to pass up such an opportunity. Besides, the Scots were also eyeing our land, and strong garrisons in the northern forts helped to dissuade them from invasion. If we left adequate men in the fortresses, then we could only lead some 350 household warriors to Cumberland, and that strength, such as it was, would be whittled down if we were to wander from settlement to settlement, fighting skirmishes and with no aim but to find our enemy, who would be watching us and ambushing us. I had persuaded C. Trigger that our best course was to discover the wolf's lair, and then march straight there and crush him, but that meant finding an enemy who was evidently well hidden. The largest warband that I dispatched west was led by my son, who took 43 warriors to follow the great wall that the Romans had built across Britain. The old stone-built forts of the wall had attracted settlers, and I reckoned it was worth inquiring of them if they had news of Skoll. "But if you find him," I warned my son, "do not pick a fight."
"You want me to run away?"
"If my elder brother had run away," I told him, "he'd be the Lord of Bebbanburg now, not me. Sometimes the cleverest thing to do in war is to run." And so I waited. And while I waited, I had one unpleasant duty: to talk with Aelswith, my son's wife. She was Athelhelm the Younger's sister, and had accompanied her father when he was my prisoner in Bebbanburg, and while she was staying at her father's side through his final illness, she had become pregnant. I could not blame my son. Aelswith was a fragile, delicate and beautiful girl with hair like fairy gold, a skin pale as milk, and a face that could drive a man crazed with desire.
"She's a goddamn elf,"
Finan had decided when he first saw her, and my fear was that the elf would prove too delicate for childbirth. But she had survived her firstborn and now carried a second child. The wise women in the village and among my men's wives declared that she was healthy, though to make certain they burned mandrake root, powdered the ashes that they mixed with cow's milk, then smeared the paste on her belly. She was Christian, of course, but when I gave her a necklace from which hung a little golden cat, one of the symbols of Freya who protected women in childbirth, she wore it. She was wearing it on the day that my son led his warband south and west, and when he was gone from sight, I walked with her on Bebbanburg's seaward ramparts. It was a blustery day, and the sea was flecked with restless white. The breakers roared on the sand beneath us, and the wind lifted strands of her fair hair as we walked.
"I love this place," she said.
"Do you?"
"Of course, Lord."
"Your home in Wessex was surely more comfortable."
"Oh, yes, Lord," she said brightly. "But I feel free here, Lord."
She offered me a smile that could have dimmed the sun. She had been 13 when she came to Bebbanburg, and before my son ruined her father's plans, had been reckoned as one of the most desirable brides in all the Saxon lands. Her father's immense wealth and power would have ensured a dowry of royal proportions, and kings from across the sea had sent emissaries to her father's hall, and those emissaries had carried back reports of her beauty. Her father had guarded her carefully because he planned to marry her to a man who would increase his power. He had intended that Aelswith would be the bride of a great lord, or even a king's wife, to be hung with jewels and crowned with gold. Yet such had been his hatred of me, that he had been prepared to offer her to my cousin to ensure that I never regained Bebbanburg, and better still, died in the attempt. Instead, my cousin was dead, Æthelhelm the Older was in his grave, and his prized daughter was walking the ramparts of Bebbanburg in a woolen dress, a sealskin cloak, and wearing a pagan amulet. "You know," I said carefully, "that I met your brother in Tamworthin."
"Yes, Lord."
We hardly spoke.
"You told me, Lord," she said meekly.
"What I didn't tell you," I added brutally, "is that he tried to kill me." She was, I thought, too young to know how to respond, and merely uttered an elfin squeak of either surprise or shock. We walked on. "And I have to tell you," I continued, "that I have made an oath."
"An oath, Lord?"
"To kill your brother." She again made the small noise, then turned and stared at the great grey waters where the white caps rippled to the horizon. There were no ships in sight, just wind-shredded waves that broke in bright spray against the Farney Islands. I looked down at her face, expecting to see tears in her blue eyes, but instead she was half-smiling.
"My brothers," she said, still gazing at the sea, "were never kind to me, Lord, and Æthelhelm was always the cruelest."
"Cruel?"
"He's much older than I am," she said.
"Much older.
And he didn't like me."
"Did he beat you?"
"Not badly, not often. But he was spiteful. Mother once gave me a necklace of jet. It was beautiful, and Æthelhelm took it. He took whatever he wanted, and if I cried he would slap me. But only slap."
She shook her head.
"He gave the necklace to one of the kitchen slaves."
"Who doubtless earned it on her back," I said. She looked up at me, surprised, then laughed.
"She did," she said. "And 9 months later, she gave birth to a little girl, but the baby died."
She instinctively put a hand on the golden cat, then put her arm through mine.
"When I was 8, my father gave me a pony, and I called him Stiffir because he looked like a fat little pig."
She laughed, remembering her pony.
"And the first time I tried to ride Stiffir, my brother put thistles under the saddle. He thought it was funny. Of course, Stiffir bucked and I was thrown. I broke my leg."
"Didn't your father punish him?"
"He laughed too."
She looked up at me earnestly.
"Father wasn't always unkind. He could be generous."
I drew her on, walking north on the high fighting platform. "So, will you be angry with me if I kill your brother?" I asked.
"He's your enemy, Lord. I know that."
She hesitated, then frowned.
"But I'm your daughter now," she added fiercely. "So I'll pray for you."
It seemed that telling my daughter-in-law that I'd sworn to slaughter her brother was not so difficult after all, but finding Skoll was proving more than difficult. For a start, he must have known we were searching for him, because 2 of my search parties had been pursued and 1 man killed, and none of the scouts returned with any useful news. A messenger came from Jofawick to tell me that Seatrigger's men were being equally unsuccessful.
"It's as if Skoll is a ghost, Lord," the messenger told me. "Everyone has heard of him. No one knows where he is."
"Or they're too frightened to speak," I suggested.
"King Seatrigger believes the sorcerer can hide Skoll's home, Lord, that he can wrap it in cloud."
I touched my hammer and feared for my son. We were not just fighting Skoll, and he was formidable enough, but his sorcerer too. I had told Uhtred the Younger to be back within 10 days, but 2 weeks passed and still he had not returned. Aylesworth spent hours praying in Bebbanburg's small chapel, while Finan, more usefully, led 30 men south and west, seeking news in every settlement, but folk had heard nothing of any fight in the far hills.
"He'll come back,"
Edith assured me. She had found me on Bebbanburg's landward rampart, gazing into the hills.
"He can be headstrong," I said.
"Like you,"
she responded with a smile and put her arm through mine.
"He'll come back, I promise."
"You see the future?" I asked sceptically.
"You tell me to trust my instinct," she said, "and I tell you he'll be back."
Edith had once been my enemy and now was my wife. She was a clever woman, skilled in the intricate dance of ambitious men, the steps of which she had learned as the mistress of Ethelred, Ethelfled's husband, who had been the ruler of Mercia and another enemy of mine. I had told Edith of my pact with Æthelstan, and she had approved. "He'll be the next king," she said. "Æthelhelm will fight to prevent that."
"He will, but the men of Mercia will fight for Æthelstan."
And that, I thought, was probably true. Edward, when he had inherited the throne, had been embarrassed by the brand of bastardy that was attached to his eldest son, and so had sent the boy Æthelstan into Mercia to be raised by Æthelfled, which is how I had become his protector. Æthelstan might be a West Saxon by birth, but to most Mercians he was one of their own.
"And you say Archbishop Æthelm is opposed to Æthelhelm?" Edith asked.
"I think he is."
"Then the church will support Æthelstan," she said.
"Not the churchmen who take Æthelhelm's bribes. Besides, the church has no warriors."
"But most warriors fear for their souls, so they listen to the church."
"And the moment I'm dead," I said bleakly, "the church will encourage Æthelstan to invade Northumbria."
She smiled. "Then it's a good thing that your son is a Christian."
"Damn him," I said, touching the hammer, "if he's even alive." Edith tucked the cross at her breast.
"He is alive," she said. "I know it."
She was right. My son was alive, and lucky that he was. He had left with 43 men and returned with just 27, and 6 of those were wounded. They came through Bebbanburg's skull gate looking like beaten men, which they were. My son could barely meet my eyes.
"We were ambushed," he said bitterly.
It had been a carefully designed ambush. My son had almost reached the far end of the great Roman wall, and as he went he had inquired at every steading and settlement for news of Ulfhefnar or for rumours about Skoll, and he learned nothing until he reached the settlement beneath the largest fort of the Long Wall, a fort built above the river Athenum. We called that fort Spurra, because its walls stood on a commanding hill spur, and the settlement was built beneath it on the Athenum's southern bank.
"A man told us he knew where Skoll lived," my son explained. "He said Skoll had captured his 2 daughters, and he claimed he'd followed the raiders south afterwards."
"And you believed him?" I asked.
"A villager daring to follow Ulfhefnar?" "The other men said the same, Lord,"
Redbad put in. Redbad was a Frisian and devoted to my son.
2 of them had lost their daughters too."
"Who were these men?" I asked. "Danes, Norse, Saxon?"
"Saxon,"
my son answered miserably, knowing how thin his tale now sounded.
"They said they held land from the monks at Caer Ligwalid."
Caer Ligwalid was at the far end of the Great Wall. I had been there often enough and had wondered whether the coming of so many Norse to the coast of Cumberland had meant the destruction of the monastery and the town surrounding it. Nothing my son could tell me provided an answer to that, though the Saxons who had misled him had claimed that their families had taken shelter behind the monastery's high walls. "So, how many men were in this settlement?"
6,
my son said. "And they knew where Skoll lived?"
"They said he lived at Heber."
"Heber? I'd never heard of such a place. The name meant High Fort, and that could have been a description of any one of the hundreds of ancient hill forts that crowned Britain's heights."
"They couldn't describe just where it was," my son said, "but offered to take us there."
"And they were certain Skoll wasn't there," Redbad said. "They said he'd gone south, Lord, to fight off raiders."
"I thought that sounded likely," my son went on, "because Seatrigger has men in southern Cumberland."
"He does," I said.
"Only Skoll hadn't gone south,"
my son said unhappily. Skoll had been waiting on either side of a steep valley, his men concealed behind both crests, and when my son's horsemen were at the valley's centre, the Ulfhevnar had attacked. They swarmed down both slopes, grey-cloaked men in grey mail on grey horses, and my son's smaller troop stood no chance. He flinched as he described the scene. "You didn't think," I asked bitterly, "to have scouts on the high ground?"
"I believed the men who led us," he said, "and they said Skoll and most of his men were gone south."
"They were convincing, Lord,"
Redbird added loyally.
"And I reckoned any scouts we sent to the hill crests would be seen by the men he'd left to garrison Heber," my son went on, "and I wanted to approach unseen."
"And the men who led you," I asked, "were Skoll's men?" My son nodded.
"They turned uphill to join the attackers."
In some ways I could understand why my son had been deceived. If the men who had betrayed him had been Danes or Norsemen, he would have been far more cautious, but he had assumed that Saxon Christians would be his allies. Yet Skoll had clearly suborned the six men, a reminder that the leader of the Ulfhevnar was a subtle man. Rumour said he hated the Christians and took a delight in killing priests, but he evidently knew how to seduce and use them too. My son had only escaped because Skoll had attacked a moment too late. The Ulfhevnar had ridden recklessly down the valley's slopes, but instead of striking the head of my son's column, the horsemen had severed it in half. The men at the rear had stood no chance, but my son and those who survived with him had spurred away. They had been pursued, of course, and two more were lost in that wild chase, but Bebbanburg's horses were good, and my son had come home. He had come home defeated, and I knew that bitter feeling of failure, made even more dreadful by the need to tell women and children that their husband and father was dead. And I could taste my son's shame, that he had been so easily deceived, that he had decided foolishly to ride unfamiliar land without scouts, that he had then been humiliated by an enemy, and maybe worst of all, that he had lost the confidence of my warriors. Christians like to dream of the perfect world, a place where there is no fighting, where sword blades are hammered into ploughshares, and where the lion, whatever that is, sleeps with the lamb. It is a dream. There has always been war, and there will always be war. So long as one man wants another man's wife, or another man's land, or another man's cattle, or another man's silver, so long will there be war. And so long as one priest preaches that his God is the only God, or the better God, there will be war. King Alfred, a man who loved peace because peace encouraged prayer, education and prosperity, nevertheless wanted to conquer the land held by the Danes and wipe out the worship of the old gods. He would have done that by persuasion if he could, but what could persuade the Danes to surrender their land, their rulers and their religion? Only the sword. And so the peace-loving Alfred beat his ploughshares into swords, raised armies, and set about his Christian duty of converting his enemies. And so long as there is war, there will be warlords, leaders. What makes a man follow a leader? Success. A warrior wants victory. He wants silver. He wants land. And he looks to his lord for all those things. My son was not a bad warrior. Indeed, I was proud of him, and when I die he will hold Bebbanburg, just as his son will hold it. But to hold the fortress, he needs men who have confidence in him. Men who will follow him in the expectation of victory. One defeat at Skoll's hand would not destroy his reputation, but now he needed a victory to show my men that he was a leader who could give them the land, silver, and cattle they craved. The easy way to give him some success was to send him north into the Scottish lands in search of plunder, but with Skoll threatening Northumbria, the last thing I wanted to do was stir the Scots to anger. One enemy at a time is prudent. Besides, I reflected, there would soon be fighting enough, and Uhtred the Younger would have his opportunity. And then I thought, if leadership is about success, how had Skoll survived? He had lost his lands in Ireland and had retreated eastwards across the sea. He had led his men across Northumbria, pierced the gate of Yeofawick, and there been repulsed. He had pursued me south towards Manchester, and then had refused battle, preferring to retreat. None of it suggested success. He had managed to capture some cattle and slaves, but his setbacks were far greater than his gains. Yet all I knew of him suggested that his power grew. The Northmen were famous for deserting an unsuccessful leader, their loyalty dissolving with a warlord's defeats, yet Skoll's reputation grew. Men feared him, and they feared his Ulfhjeldnar. But fear had little force against failure, and Skoll had failed. Yet his men did not desert him. Indeed, even more men were swearing allegiance to him. "It's his damned sorcerer," Finan said. That was surely the answer. That Snorri was so feared that even Skoll's failures could not hurt men's faith in his ultimate success. Skoll possessed a sorcerer who could spy the future through blind eyes and use those empty sockets to kill men at a distance. I feared him. Men talked of Greyfang, Skoll's sword, but his real weapon was Snorri. And it was the sorcerer's reputation that persuaded ever more men to fly Skoll's flag of the snarling wolf from their hall roofs, that brought ships of men from Ireland and from the western isles of Scotland to give Skoll their oaths. His power grew, and each report made me regret that we had not ridden sooner. Folk said Skoll led 500 warriors. A week later it was 700. And neither Sea Trigger nor I knew the truth, any more than we knew where to find Skoll. "Heber," I said in frustration. "Maybe there's no such place as Heber." Yet Sea Trigger's scouts had heard the same name. It seemed Heber existed, but where? I began to fear the rumours that Skoll's formidable sorcerer did indeed possess the mysterious power to conceal his fortress. And then, when I was close to despairing that we would ever solve the mystery, it was unravelled in the most unexpected way. It happened on a day when a letter was brought to Bevanburg. The letter was from Æthelstan in Chester, and was sent to Sea Trigger, who in turn sent it on to me, carried by the priest who had brought the letter from Mercia. That priest was Father Swithrid, Æthelstan's confessor, who was escorted by 6 Mercian warriors and accompanied by a younger priest who seemed terrified of Swithrid's disapproving eyes and sour tongue. "We have been dispatched," Swithrid told me haughtily, "to make certain King Seatrigger is keeping to the terms agreed at Tamworthen. We were also charged with delivering this letter to the king." He handed me the letter, but gave me no chance to read it. "Under the treaty," he went on, "King Seatrigger promised to protect the Christians in his realm." "He did," I confirmed. "Yet King Skoll has slaughtered every missionary in Cumberland," he said indignantly. "King Skoll?" I asked, stressing the king. "So he now styles himself." "So he now styles himself Lord," I said pointedly, waited until he had said the word, then unfolded the letter. Æthelstan had written that he had received disturbing news from the land south of the Ribble. "Which land," he had written, "is ours to govern on behalf of our father King Edward, and into which territory have come Christian folk fleeing the vile persecution of the heathen who calls himself King Skoll. This same Skoll has sent troops into our land below the Ribble and done great harm to our folk, to their livestock and to their homes. Worse, to the great sadness of all Christians, the brethren we have sent to be a light to the Gentiles have been foully put to martyrdom." The letter went on to point out that it was Northumbria's responsibility to stop Skoll, "and if you should be wayward in that duty, our good King Edward will send forces into your land to punish the malefactor." "Skoll has really killed your missionaries?" I asked Swithrid. I talked to him in the sunlight outside the Great Hall. I'd sent his escort and the nervous young priest to find food and ale.
"He has martyred them," Swithrid said in disgust.
"Strange," I said, "because some Christian Saxons have allied with him."
"The devil stalks the land," Swithrid said, "and works his mischief."
I read the letter again. It was formal and cold, which suggested to me it was not Æthelstan's work, even though it bore his seal and signature, but had probably been written by a priest.
"Did you write this?" I asked Swithrid. "To the prince's orders, yes."
"And a copy was sent to King Edward?"
"Of course."
I waited until at last, reluctantly.
"Lord."
The letter, I thought, was really intended for Edward, assuring him of Æthelstan's loyalty. But nevertheless it confirmed that Skoll was getting stronger, and it also hinted that Skoll's savagery might give the Saxons reason to declare that the treaty had been broken, and so provide them with an excuse to invade Cumberland. And if that invasion happened, Northumbria would never again rule the western part of its own land. By conquest it would become a part of Saxon Inglaland.
"I trust you will extirpate this heathen,"
Father Swithrid said when I had finished reading, then added, again reluctantly,
"Lord."
"I am sworn to kill him," I said curtly. I did not need a Saxon priest to tell me my duty.
"You say that, and you do nothing,"
Swithrid retorted. And then his eyes opened in amazement as a gangly man climbed the steps to the rock platform in front of Bevenberg's great hall where we talked. The approaching man had white hair that hung to his waist and an aged face that was alight with enthusiasm, but what had astonished Father Swithrid were the man's clothes, for he was dressed in a cassock, a chasuble, a pallium, and a mitre, and he carried a bishop's crozier in his left hand, while on his right he wore a heavy silver ring studded with amber. He seemed excited to see Father Swithrid, and, ignoring me, he held his right hand towards the tall priest.
"Kiss it!"
he ordered.
"Kiss it, man!"
Father Swithrid was so taken aback and perhaps so overwhelmed by the stranger's radiant garments that he half bowed and dutifully kissed the bishop's ring.
"Have you come from Rome?"
the long-haired man demanded sternly.
"No,"
Swithrid stammered, still confused.
"You're not from Rome?"
The newcomer was outraged.
"From Chester." "What earthly or heavenly use is Chester? The papal throne is in Rome, you benighted fool, you goat-dropping, you spawn of Beelzebub. The keys of the fishermen shall be mine, God has decreed it."
Father Swithrid, hearing the man speaking English with a Danish accent, was recovering his wits. He stepped back, frowning. There were enough Danes who had become Christians, but none, so far as I knew, had yet been made into a bishop.
"Who are you?" Swithrid demanded.
"I am he who will govern Christ's kingdom on earth. I am the Lord's anointed."
"Father Swithrid," I intervened, "meet Bishop Jeremias." Swithrid's reaction was all I could have wished for. He took another backward step, sketched the sign of the cross towards Jeremias, and looked furious.
"You heretic," he spat. "You disciple of Satan."
"Bishop Jeremias," I rubbed salt into Swithrid's wounded pride, "is my tenant on Lindisfarne. You owe me rent, Bishop."
"The Lord will provide,"
Jeremias said airily. "You said that 6 months ago, and the Lord still hasn't provided."
"I will remind him,"
Jeremias said. In truth, I never expected any rent from Jeremias, and I was not at all sure that Lindisfarne was mine to let anyway. It was church land, the home of St. Cuthbert's great monastery that had been ransacked and burned by the Danes a generation before. The church had yet to reoccupy the island, which, by tradition, fell under the protection of Bebbanburg, and, much to the fury of most churchmen, I had allowed Jeremias and his followers to settle in the ruins of the old monastic house. Their fury, I suspected, was because Jeremias was about as good a Christian as I was. His real name was Dagfinnir Gunderson, but Jarl Dagfinnir the Dane had turned himself into Jeremias, a self-appointed bishop. He had served Ragnar the Younger, whose father had raised me, and one morning Dagfinnir had appeared naked in Dunholm's great hall and announced that he was now the son of the Christian God and had adopted the name Jeremias and demanded that Ragnar, a pagan, should worship him. Breda, Ragnar's woman and a hater of all Christians, insisted that Dagfinnir should be put to death, but Ragnar had been amused and let Jeremias live. The bishop was mad, of course, but even the moon-touched can make some sense, and Jeremias had thrived. He had owned a ship that he renamed Gudsmode and used it to fish, and his success attracted a following of landless men and women whom he called his flock.
"I have brought you a message from God, Lord," he now said, waving the angry Swithrid to one side and explaining his visit to me. "But first I must tell you with great joy that the flock has been diligent and made salt, which you may buy from us."
"I already have salt, Bishop."
"He's no bishop," Swithrid hissed. "May the devil fart in your mouth," Jeremias said loftily, "and worms shit in your soup."
He turned back to me.
"My salt is no common salt, Lord. It is blessed by our Redeemer. It is our Saviour's salt."
He smiled triumphantly.
"If you buy it, Lord," he added slyly, "I will have silver to give you as rent."
I sometimes thought he was not mad at all, and like Ragnar, I was amused by him.
"I gave you silver last week," I reminded him, "for the herring and salmon." "I gave those coins to the poor, Lord, as the Lamb of God commanded me."
"You being the poor?" I asked.
"The Son of Man hath nowhere to lay his head," Jeremias said mysteriously,
then turned on Swithrid, who was looking appalled.
"Are you married?"
"I am not," Swithrid said stiffly.
"I find a wife's breasts make a fine pillow," Jeremias said brightly. "Our Lord should have married. He'd have slept better."
"Heretic,"
Swithrid spat.
"May maggots crawl up your arse," Jeremias said,
then turned to me, and for a moment I thought he was going to ask me about Edith's breasts. But it seemed he had other matters on his mind.
"You have heard of Skoll the Norseman, Lord?"
I was startled by the question. "Of course I have."
"The heathen tyrant who calls himself a king," Jeremias said scornfully.
He had changed to his native Danish, presumably because he did not want Swithrid to follow the conversation.
"He is an enemy of God, Lord. Have you met him?"
"I have."
"And you live! God be praised!"
"How do you know of Skoll?" He gave me a puzzled look.
"How do I know? Lord, you do speak to your servants, don't you?"
"Of course I do."
"Well, I am God's servant."
"And he talks to you?"
"Of course he does, and at great length."
He glanced at Father Swithrid, as if to make sure the priest was not understanding what we said.
"God brings me tidings, Lord, but there are times," he had lowered his voice, "when I wish he would speak less. I'm not married to him."
"So you've heard stories of Skoll," I said, trying to move the conversation on. I doubted Jeremias's God had whispered the news to him, but lurid tales of Skoll's cruelty were spreading across Northumbria and could easily have reached Lindisfarne.
"The heathen has come from his high place," Jeremias intoned, and it is the Lord's will that you smite him. That is God's message for you, Lord, that you smite him.
He hitched up his mud-stained cassock to reveal a pouch hanging from the belt of his breeches. He fished in the pouch and brought out a stone about the size of a walnut, which he offered to me.
This, Lord, will assist in the smiting.
A pebble? I asked.
That, Lord, he said in an awed tone, is the very same sling stone with which David slew Goliath.
I took the stone, which looked exactly like a million others on Linda's Foreigner's beaches. I knew Jeremias collected relics, all of them worthless, but all in his mind were real and sacred. "Are you sure you want me to carry this?" I asked.
"God commanded me to give it to you, Lord, to grant you great smiting. That stone is a very holy and very precious object, and will give you the power to overcome all enemies."
He made the sign of the cross, and Father Swithered hissed disapproval.
"Turds, spew from your tongue!"
Jeremiah spoke English again, glaring at Swithered. I thought back to something Jeremiah had said a moment before. "You mentioned a high place."
"The heathen is exalted," Jeremiah said, "and must be brought low."
"You know Skoll lives in a high place?" I asked carefully, never quite sure whether Jeremias was listening to me, let alone telling me the truth.
"Very high, Lord. His place of refuge touches the sky and lies above the pit of silver."
I stared at him.
"You know where it is?" "Of course I know."
He suddenly sounded entirely sane.
"Do you remember Jarl Halfdan the Mad?"
I shook my head. "Should I?"
"He lost his wits, poor man, and led an assault on Dunholm. Jarl Ragnar killed him, of course, and then we all went north and laid his home waste. That was before God called me to his service."
Jeremias used one end of his intricately embroidered pallium to blow his nose, making Father Swithered flinch.
"Halfdan the Mad's fort is a very nasty place, Lord. The Romans built it."
"Where is it?"
"Lord, Lord, Lord," Jeremiah said, evidently calling on his God to help him remember. "You know the road from Jorvik to Caer Llygelyd?"
"I know it."
"About an angel's flight from Caer Llygelyd, another Roman road goes north into the fells. It climbs, Lord. If you follow that road, you'll find Halfdan's fort. It's lost in the hills, very far and very high."
"Heber," I said.
"It is high," Jeremiah said, "and the higher you climb, the nearer you come to God."
"I was thinking of building a tower, Lord."
"How far is an angel's flight?" I asked. "A very high tower, Lord, to make it more convenient for God to speak with me."
"Angel's flight?" I reminded him.
"Oh, just a half day's walk, Lord."
His face lit up as he remembered something.
"Halfdan's fortress lies above the headwaters of the South Tyne. Follow that river's valley, and you must come to where you can smite him. But pray, Lord, pray. Halfdan's fort is formidable. A wall, banks, and ditches. But I shall beseech God that he grants you good smiting. The Lord of hosts is with you. You cannot fail to smite mightily."
"But how can you be certain that Heber is Halfdan's fort?" I asked, praying that the answer would not be that his God had told him.
"I can't be certain," Jeremiah said, sounding perfectly sane, "but all the reports say that Skoll lives above the pit of silver. Where else can it be?"
Some instinct told me that Jeremias's recollection of Ragnar the Younger's raid was the truth, which meant that Heber lay not too far south of the Great Wall, and not too distant from the place where my son had been ambushed. "The Pit of Silver?" I asked him. Jeremias looked at me as though I were the mad one. Then understanding dawned.
"There were lead mines there, Lord."
"And silver is smelted from lead," I said.
"From the darkness cometh light," Jeremias said happily, "and silver must be given to the poor, Lord."
He looked pointedly at the slingstone I was still holding.
"That is a very valuable relic, Lord. King David himself handled it."
Meaning he wanted silver, and because he had told me what I needed to know, I gave him coins. He sniffed them, looked happy, then turned to the sea.
"The tide is rising, Lord. May I rest my head here tonight?"
"Did you bring your own pillow?" I asked. He offered me a sly smile.
"She is below, Lord,"
he said, pointing down into the lower fortress. Jeremias would be unable to get home that evening, because at high tide the causeway to Lindisfarne was under water, and the mad bishop was often sane enough to visit Bebbanburg just as a flooding tide would prevent him from riding home, and just in time to share the garrison's supper, which I suspected was a lot better than anything his followers cooked.
"And maybe we could have a morsel to eat," he added.
"You will be welcome," I told him, and so he was, because I reckoned he had told me where I could find Skoll. Not that I could do anything about it. At least, not immediately, because the next day Skoll came to us. He came without anyone telling us of his presence, and that was disturbing. If a Scottish warband came hunting for slaves or cattle, we would hear about it from the folk who fled. Some would go to their hiding places in the woods or hills, but others would run or ride to warn neighbours, and so the news would spread until it reached Bebbanburg. But Skoll simply arrived without any warning. He must have led his men straight across the hills, not stopping to plunder or burn, just spurring on his horses so that he appeared on the hill above the village before anyone could reach us with news of his coming. He came not long after dawn on a mellow spring day, and the rising sun glinted from the mail, helmets and spear blades of his grey-cloaked horsemen. "They must have ridden half the night," Finan said. "All night, even," I said. It had been a cloudless night, and the moon was full. A horn was sounding from the great hall, summoning Bebbanburg's garrison to the ramparts. Villagers were running from their houses, driving pigs, goats, cattle, dogs, sheep and children along the narrow neck of land that led to Bebbanburg's Skoll Gate. Skoll could surely see them, but he sent none of his warriors down the hill to stop their flight. I shouted at my son to ready men who could ride out to protect the fugitives if Skoll attacked, but the Norsemen stayed on the higher ground and just watched us.
250 men,
Finan said dourly. So far, I answered, because more men were joining Skoll even as we watched. I had fewer than 60 men in the fortress. Most of my household warriors were at their steadings, and though they would soon learn enough of Skoll's arrival and would know to assemble south of the fortress, I could not expect to see them until midday at the earliest, and even then I would have fewer men than Skoll. But Skoll, too, had his problems. I suspected he had never been to Bebbanburg before, and though he had doubtless heard of its strength, he was now seeing the fortress in all its grim glory. I doubted he had any ships on Northumbria's eastern coast, so the only way to attack us was along the narrow neck of land that led to the massive defences of the Skoll Gate, and if he somehow managed to capture that outer bastion, he still had the inner gate and its mighty wall to overcome. So far as I could see, he had brought no ladders, so in truth he stood no chance of capturing the fortress, because even his fabled Ulfhedna could not overcome Bebbanburg's defences without some means of scaling the ramparts. Unless, of course, his sorcerer had the power to defeat us. And was that possible? I touched my hammer. I could fight men, but I could not fight the gods. And surely, I thought, Skoll must have known of Bebbanburg's legendary strength before coming to the fortress. So what gave him the confidence to come so boldly? Oh, dear Christ, Finan interrupted my thoughts. He was staring at the far hill. His eyes were keener than mine. What is it? I asked.
Prisoners, Lord.
It was my turn to swear. I could see the prisoners now. Four men wearing nothing but long shirts, their hands tied, their bodies draped over pack horses like sacks of grain.
My son's men, I said quietly.
Like as not. By now there were almost 300 men on the far hill, and Skoll had raised his standard, the flag of the snarling wolf. I could see him clearly, his white cloak bright in the early sunshine. He was waiting, knowing we watched him, and ignoring the fugitives panicked from the village, who had almost all reached the fortress. He was gloating, I thought. He had not come to capture a fortress, but to show how little he feared us. And when he did approach, he came slowly, his whole line of men riding sedately downhill and threading its way between the houses that lined the harbour. I thought men would dismount to plunder the abandoned village, but instead they all followed Skoll onto the narrow neck of land. The prisoners came with them.
"Can you see who they are?" I asked Finan.
"Not yet."
The approaching warriors stopped at the causeway's narrowest point, where Skoll dismounted. He handed his helmet to one of his followers and then, accompanied by just one man, walked towards the Skoll Gate. He stopped after a few paces, drew his great sword, Grey Fang, and rammed it into the sand, then spread his arms wide to show he came to talk, not to fight. He walked on another few paces, then stopped and waited. His companion was Snorri. I had only seen Snorri at a distance. Now I could see him clearly, and he was far more frightening than Skoll. He was as tall as Skoll, but where Skoll was broad and heavily built, the sorcerer was thin as a wraith, his grey and white striped robe hanging loose from his shoulders like a shroud. His eye sockets were red scars in a bony face that was framed by a long tangle of white hair that hung past his white beard that was plaited into three ropes. He was led by a small white dog on a leash. He carried the leash in his right hand, while in his left was a wolf skull. I touched my hammer and saw Finan clutch at his cross. The Christians have priests, whom I am pleased to call sorcerers because it annoys them, but Christians condemn sorcery. They believe their nailed god could walk on water, heal the sick, and summon devils from the mad, but they claim those feats are not magic, and spit on those of us who understand that the world can never be explained, that magic belongs to the spirit realm, and that some men and women are given the ability to understand the inexplicable. Those folk are the sorcerers and sorceresses, and we revere them even as we fear them. They are not priests. Our religion needs no men or women to tell us how to behave, but we do care about the will of the gods, and some folk are better than others at divining that will. Our sorcerers are often blind, like the man waiting for us outside the Skoll Gate, because the blind can often see further into the shadows where the restless spirits live. Ravan, Ragnar the Fearless's father, had been a blind sorcerer, though he preferred to say he was a skald, what we would call a skop or shaper, a man who makes poems.
"I am a skald," Ravan told me on our first meeting, "a weaver of dreams, a man who makes glory from nothing and dazzles you with its making."
He had laughed at his own immodesty, but in truth he was much more than a man who made songs. I learned in my childhood to understand that Ravan the Skald, though blind, could see things we others could not.